Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure with you for the next half hour. In our top stories today, in an exclusive interview with Vatican Radio, the U.S. ambassador to the Holy See reacts to a troop buildup in Iraq and comments on Pope Benedict's recent speech to diplomats. Researchers find a new source of highly productive stem cells in amniotic fluid. Is it a morally acceptable alternative to stem cells from human embryos? And how the Catholic Church and Orthodox Jews find common ground on ethical issues affecting family and human life. From debt cancellation for poor nations to the need for development, justice, and peace across a troubled world, Pope Benedict XVI's speech at the start of the new year to diplomats covered these and other issues of concern for the Catholic Church in the new millennium. The Holy Father focused one large segment of his address on the urgency of resolving widening conflicts in Africa and in the Middle East. Charles Collins sat down with the United States Ambassador to the Holy See, Francis Rooney, for his reaction to Pope Benedict's address. Let's listen.
We are sitting with the Ambassador to the Holy See from the United States, Mr. Francis Rooney, who presented his letters of credence to the Holy Father back on November 13th, 2005. And although we've spoken to him several times before, this is the first time we've had the Ambassador in our studios. Welcome, Ambassador Rooney.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's just get down to it. Yesterday evening, President Bush gave a speech on Iraq. The president pointed out that since elections in 2005, al-Qaeda and Sunni terrorist attacks have continued in the country, and a vicious cycle of sectarian violence, as he put it, is continuing.
So America will change our strategy to help the Iraqis carry out their campaign to put down sectarian violence and bring security to the people of Baghdad. This will require increasing American force levels. So I've committed more than 20,000 additional American troops to Iraq.
Again, the president says he'll be sending these additional troops to the country, and he's saying that they'll keep terrorists and insurgents from returning to areas where they've been cleared out by U.S. forces.
Our past efforts to secure Baghdad failed for two principal reasons. There were not enough Iraqi and American troops to secure neighborhoods that had been cleared of terrorists and insurgents, and there were too many restrictions on the troops we did have. Our military commanders reviewed the new Iraqi plan to ensure that it addressed these mistakes. They report that it does. They also report that this plan can work.
Now, there have been several changes in the past since the invasion of 2003, trying to change things to bring security and peace to the country. Why is this new plan so different?
Any military operation is an evolving situation as they encounter different conditions than they expected. And I think this shows quite clearly the pragmatic flexibility of the president to try to adapt our strategy and our policies to the conditions that we keep encountering. Apparently what's happened here, as the president said, that neighborhoods would be cleared and for a variety of reasons, terms of engagement, as he said, and other things, the headway that was made would be lost after those neighborhoods were evacuated by the security forces, and there hasn't been time for the seed of political stability and institutional stability to take root, to take the place of the military stability. And so now we're going to come back in with more military stability, hopefully enough time to give that seed to take root, that the next time when neighborhoods are evacuated by the military, there will be enough civil institutions in place to maintain the gains that have been achieved.
In his speech, the president said that America's commitment to this government is not open-ended. What exactly does he mean when he says that?
Well, I think, as the president said, at the end of the day, the Iraqis have to take responsibility for their country, and they're trying. And our role is to help them develop these civil institutions and military institutions and other basis on which they can build a democratic and free country. And we can't stay there forever, but we need to stay there long enough and hard enough to get the job done.
Now, of course, Iraq was a focus in Pope Benedict's speech to the diplomatic corps accredited to the Holy See on Monday. You were, of course, in attendance at that event. It was one of many points the Pope talked about. What were your general impressions of the Holy Father's speech?
As in most everything that the Holy Father says, we're just, as the United States, is just deeply thankful for his courage and leadership in the world right now. He's a tremendously, in addition to being a tremendously holy leader of the Catholic Church, he's a very important participant in the world stage right now, and offers the world great promise in finding solutions to some of the fairly heinous and widespread challenges that freedom and democracy face, particularly in the Middle East being one of them.
Now, speaking of the Middle East, he talked about the Middle East as a whole, but specifically mentioning Iraq, the situation with Iran, encouraging it to come into the international community, especially with its nuclear program. He talked about Israel and the Palestinians. What role does the United States have to play in all of these fields?
Well, I think the Holy Father, in both of the two comments he made, both that Israel has a right to live in peace and the Palestinians have a right to a free homeland, and then the very clear and unmistakable comment about Iran, that they need to provide a satisfactory response to the legitimate concerns of the international community. I don't think the Holy Father could say it any more clearly. And again, that shows a great deal of alignment with most of the civilized world in hoping that Iran will respond to the UN and the international organizations and abandon its nuclear weapon efforts and focus on living peacefully in the Middle East.
Now, moving on to another part of the world, actually kind of close to that part of the world, he spent most of his speech, when he's going through the different parts of the world, on Africa, and he began by speaking about the Darfur crisis. Every week we seem to say the continuing crisis in Darfur, the international community still doing nothing. Why is what's happening in Darfur continuing? Why hasn't the international community stepped up to stop what the mass killings happening there?
I think that's a real good question. I think that either the president or it was Secretary of State Colin Powell were the first to call Darfur genocide and to give it the visibility that it deserves. Why the rest of the world has not been more forceful in bringing visibility to that problem is well beyond my scheme of intelligence, but. I know the United States is committed to trying to resolve it and to see the humanitarian crisis end. And in fact, there's really nobody in the world doing more for Africa than the United States. Between the $15 billion PEPFAR program, which dwarfs the amount of money that's being spent by the Global Fund or anybody else on AIDS remediation, and then the fact that we're by far and away the largest donor to the World Food Program, I'd like to see some other countries step up.
Well, you mentioned this program for the helping with AIDS. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, the president's committed a couple of years ago to $15 billion during his term to try to solve and cure AIDS in Africa. And that's a massive leap up from the amount of money that had been spent theretofore. And one of the interesting sidelights of it is when the president did step up and the United States stepped up, then a lot of other countries got behind this global fund. But nobody really paid a lot of attention to the global fund until the United States stepped up.
Talking about human rights and the importance of human rights, he said that the fundamental human right, the first human right, is, of course, the right to religious liberty. The United States actually does have an ambassadorial position for religious liberty at the State Department. What is the United States doing to promote religious liberty in the so many countries around the world where people do not have the right to worship as they please?
Well, as you know, Charlie, if you read our national security strategy right in the very beginning, it's based upon the notion that we need to advance human dignity and freedom in the world, and that the primary freedoms of freedom, assembly, press and religion have to be guaranteed to provide human dignity to people. The president even spoke directly to Hu Jintao about that about a year ago when he was in China, talking about religious freedom as being one of the as being exactly as you say the linchpin to the creation of the other freedoms, which will enable true democracy and pluralism to flourish. The Holy Father's comments really are heartwarming, as all the Holy Father's comments are to me, in that it shows the great alignment between the values of the American people and the feelings of the Holy Father about the importance of promoting religious freedom and the other essential freedoms which flow with it and from it in the world.
One place where there isn't full freedom of religion, of course, is Cuba. The Holy Father mentioned that. He wants Cuba to open itself up to the world, but also the world to open itself up to Cuba. And of course, the United States has a long history with Cuba, and of course, the United States has an embargo against Cuba right now, and also a large Cuban-American community. What were your thoughts on the Pope's words on Cuba?
Well, there's a bit of a range of thoughts. You know, the embargo is a complicated situation in the U.S. with strategic and political foundations, which are difficult to deal with. I mean, I don't think the embargo is going anywhere as long as Castro is alive, and that's just a fact we have to live with. But Castro is not going to be here forever, and we may be even seeing the end of the Castro regime now, from what many people understand, including the church. And that presents a great opportunity both for all peace and democracy-loving countries, and certainly for the church to play a constructive role in assuring that the seeds of democracy get planted right when this opportunity for change comes up, and that we don't rush to some kind of premature mistake that would defer the ability of the people to make their own choices in Cuba. I.e., to put it in a nutshell, what we really are hoping that we're going to see is a transition to democracy, not a succession. And I think that the Catholic Church is so important in Cuba, despite the efforts of Castro probably to annihilate religion for a couple of generations. I think the Cuban people are going to respond, I hope they do, with resurgence in their essential historical Catholic faith, and that the church will have an opportunity to play its usual humanizing, spiritually enriching role, which should play into the opportunity to help create these freedoms, freedom of assembly, freedom of religion, which will give rise to possibility of some democratic elections and fair voting, which would prevent a succession and an anointment of another dictator and would allow a transition to democracy.
And a final point, the Holy Father, again, near the beginning of his speech, he mentioned security issues. Mentioned that they were aggravated by terrorism. Of course, the United States is the leader of what he calls a coalition against terror. Now, there's a debate on whether or not this is the best way to handle terrorism in our midst. What do you see as how the Holy See and the United States agree on any of these significant security issues? Is there any cause of agreement there?
I think there's a great deal of alignment between the United States and the Holy See, and really most peace-loving nations in the Holy See. When the Holy Father calls for the application of reason in terms of interpreting religion, and when he calls for when he makes it very clearly that religion cannot be used and should not be used as a tool for the propagation of political agendas and violence and murder and mayhem, I think he's saying things that any peace-loving nation has got to respect and support and want to aid. Sometimes countries disagree on tactics, particularly when you get into military-related things, but there's a lot of bad actors in the world right now, and a lot of them pertain to this radical Islamicism, which is not religious Islam. There's a whole lot of truly religious Muslims who are trying to make their way in the world, just like truly religious Catholics, and we have to work to give those people an opportunity to work within their religion. And I think the Holy Father's commented on that too. The religion needs to be separated from those people who are using it for a political agenda.
And a very warm thanks there to the United States Ambassador to the Holy See, Francis Rooney. The U.S. Congress has given the thumbs up to expanding federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. The bill was passed by the House of Representatives by 253 votes to 174. But President George Bush has pledged to exercise his veto against it once again, as he did last year on an identical bill. Meanwhile, the Catholic Church has welcomed details of a new study in which stem cells were extracted from the amniotic fluid that protects babies in the womb. A team of U.S. researchers from Wake Forest University in North Carolina say the cells taken from the fluid have the potential to turn into a wide variety of different tissues that could one day repair damaged human organs. The discovery may offer an ethically acceptable alternative to stem cells obtained from human embryos. The Catholic Church and other religious groups oppose stem cell research on human embryos because the process involves the destruction of a human life. Susie Hodges tells us more.
The Vatican has welcomed the discovery of a new way of extracting stem cells that does not use human embryos. Cardinal Javier Lozano Barragan, head of the Pontifical Council for Health, said the Church welcomes real scientific progress for the benefit of patients that neither threatens nor manipulates human life.
I think it is something that maybe have no problems with the ethics point of view, because in principle it was not against the life of the donor. If these conditions are all realized, I am very glad to see this progress in the field of science for the good of the humankind.
Dr. Anthony Atala was the leader of the research team at Wake Forest University that published their findings on the use of stem cells from the amniotic fluid. He began by telling me why this research was so significant.
The significance really is just that it's one additional stem cell type. We were looking for alternate stem cell types and started this search approximately 7 years ago.
Why did you decide to look for different sources? Was it perhaps partly because of ethical concerns surrounding embryonic stem cells?
It was mostly due to the need for a larger supply of cells that we could use for therapy. And it just made sense that the amniotic fluid, which is the fluid that surrounds the baby during development, while the mother carries the baby in her womb, and the placenta, which is the tissue that surrounds both the fluid and the baby, could be possible sources of stem cells.
The stem cells used in his research were taken from samples extracted during amniocentesis, a test used to check for defects in the unborn baby that sometimes could be the prelude to an abortion. So does he see any ethical problem with this?
Well, you know, interestingly, that is why you would only obtain that fluid if there's a routine amniocentesis procedure being done, because you don't need to do an amniocentesis just to get these cells, because you can wait until the baby's born to get it from the placenta, and then there's no risk to either mother or the baby.
Richard Durflinger is the deputy director of the U.S. Catholic Church's Pro-Life Secretariat, and he gave me his reaction to the finding of this new study.
Well, this is a very significant study, especially since the researchers did such a very rigorous and careful job of testing these cells to make sure that they are very, very flexible, can make a variety of different cell types, rivaling perhaps the versatility of embryonic stem cells, with apparently no danger of tumor formation, a problem which has plagued the embryonic stem cells, and of course without the moral problem of destroying life. This is also one in a series of recent studies showing a much greater versatility in cells from adult tissue and also from other byproducts of live birth, much more versatility than was once imagined. Umbilical cord blood, the tissue of the umbilical cord itself, the placenta, the amniotic fluid, the amniotic membrane, all have been found to have very versatile stem cells. And so what we're looking at is an entire body of scientific knowledge indicating that it is not premature death of the unborn that is going to provide the most useful and beneficial stem cells, but new life.
But could there be any potential ethical concerns connected with this new source of stem cells that were taken from samples used in amniocentesis?
Well, the only ethical concern would be that amniocentesis has some small risk itself. And certainly we would oppose the use of that procedure to determine that certain children who test positive for some genetic defect be aborted. But when it's used late in pregnancy, the risks are extremely small. And certainly amniocentesis itself can be used for morally legitimate purposes to help prepare for the birth of a child with special needs or even to prepare for treatment. This same study also found the same cells in the placenta. So it seems that the amniotic fluid or the placental tissue could simply be harvested at the time of live birth, and I don't see any possible moral problem with doing that.
Turning to embryonic stem cell research, the House of Representatives has passed a bill calling for broader federal funding for such research. The bill stands no chance of becoming law, as President Bush has pledged to veto it. However, Derflinger predicts proposed legislation on this same issue will be brought up again before Congress in the near future.
On embryonic stem cell research, we're expecting another year of impasse, of blockage, which is another reason why we hope Congress will really turn its attention to much more beneficial and much more ethically acceptable options for stem cell research and treatments.
However, backers of this bill are saying that they're going to bring it up before Congress again and again until, as they put it, they get a president who will sign it and not veto it. So it's not going to go away, is it, this issue?
The issue will not go away until we prove that these benefits can be obtained without the destruction of life. But the evidence is gathering for that. I've sometimes said, you know, some of our opponents we're never going to persuade. We'll just have to cure them. But unfortunately, American culture is a very pragmatic culture, and people like to see results, and they will not be persuaded only by moral arguments, just as with the issue of abortion, where the church has stepped forward to provide life-affirming alternatives for women with unexpected pregnancies, and where it has promoted better care for the terminally ill as the alternative to euthanasia. The church can and should be in the forefront of promoting these morally acceptable options to show people in a very concrete way that science and ethics can work together for the benefit of humankind.
Derflinger believes the supporters of embryonic stem cell research have their own political agenda for trying to keep this issue on the front burner.
If one wanted to be cynical, one could say that the intent this year is not to pass a bill. They don't want the issue to go away. They think it's politically useful to keep attacking President Bush as being intransigent and against medical progress. And the problem is that every time real medical progress comes forward that does not require these moral violations, people actually set themselves against them because it does not serve that agenda. They don't want, in a sense, they don't want treatments to come forward using morally acceptable means because that would not fit into their political plan.
That was Richard Derflinger, Deputy Director of the U.S. Church's Pro-Life Secretariat. And you also heard Dr. Anthony Atala, who led the research on stem cells extracted from amniotic fluid. And I'm Susie Hodges.
The Catholic Church is united with many Christian, Muslim, and Jewish groups on a wide range of ethical issues affecting the family, human life, and the dignity of the human person. Charles Collins talked about some of these modern-day challenges with Rabbi Yehuda Levin, who represents the Union of Orthodox Rabbis of the United States and Canada, and the Rabbinical Alliance of America.
Since Vatican II, there has been a remarkable rapprochement and relationship, ecumenism and dialogue between the Catholics and the Jews on so many issues. But one of the issues that has received short shrift and that's very, very important for society is the issues that are destroying the family, the issues that Cardinal Ratzinger and now Pope Benedict has been championing in such a wonderful, important way. And that is abortion, homosexuality, homosexual marriage, the homosexual agenda, internet pornography. These are things that merry-go-round divorces, no-fault divorce. These are things that are destroying Jewish, Catholic, black and white families all over the world. We've got to get together and really deal with this.
Can you give us a concrete example of how Catholics and Jews can work together on these moral issues?
In Jerusalem, which was about to have a homosexual parade and convention, the Vatican joined the chorus of religious leaders, Jewish leaders and Muslim leaders that spoke out against this, and it was postponed. And here was a new level of ecumenism where people from the Muslim community and the Catholic community at the highest levels joined with the Jewish community, and our voices were heard around the world. This is just the beginning. Hopefully, we can do the same thing in New York, where there's a large Orthodox Jewish population that is facing a homosexual marriage bill, and with the help of the Catholic Conference of Bishops, encouraged by the Vatican, I'm sure that we can take people out into the streets to defend our faith and values in a common way, and this would be a great role model to the entire world. It's very exciting what we can do in the next few months.
What about philosophical and theological discussions about some of the new issues that are coming up? You know, for example, cloning, stem cell research, things that weren't around 2,000 years ago. Do you think Catholics and Jews can get together and discuss what the ethics of these new technologies are?
Discussions of religious texts and theology are basically forbidden to Orthodox Jews. However, I am convinced that once we establish a commonality and we savor joint victories in restoring the primacy of religious leaders to the pro-family movement of activism, it should be led by religious leaders, by priests and rabbis, rather than just lay people. Once we do that, we'll find that we can discuss a lot of things that are now way out of the orbit, but we can get to them.
And that was Rabbi Yehuda Levin, representing the Union of Orthodox Rabbis of the United States and Canada and the Rabbinical Alliance of America. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.